Welcome to the podcast, Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, your host, and our focus is on mastering communication as an essential leadership skill so that you can command the room, connect with the audience, and close the deal in any context. I'm super excited for my guest this week. My guest is Amy Bernstein. Amy is the editor at Harvard Business Review, someplace where I'm sure just about everybody out there has read a lot of incredible articles on all things business. She's the vice president and executive editorial director at Harvard Business Publishing overall. And she's also the co-host of an amazing podcast, Women at Work, where I was honored to be a guest just a few weeks ago. And that is how we met. She also lives outside of Boston with her spouse and two dogs. Amy, welcome to the show.
Very happy to be here with you, Laura.
Thank you so much for allowing me to reciprocate the invitation and for accepting and being on mine. It was so much fun being on yours.
Oh, you were fabulous on ours. I hope all your listeners will tune in.
Oh, thank you so much. We'll put the link to that show in the notes to the show. And we really do want everybody to tune into both programs. Amazing, amazing stuff over at Women at Work. So what is your fun fact, Amy? What's a little known something?
You know, it's funny. When I first looked at that question, I had no idea what my fun fact was. And then you asked me about my DISC profile, or my MBTI, StrengthFinders, Myers-Briggs. I've done all those things, and I have no idea what my profiles are. I have no idea if I'm an ENTJ, MOUSE, or what.
Not a big proponent for you of those kinds of...
Oh, I think they can be useful. It just, I can't retain it. I don't remember. It's not that I reject it. I just don't remember it.
Is it funny where our brains are selective? You know, we have, it's like, I'm clear on this. My brain remembers every detail of X, Y, and Z, but these things just in one ear, out the other. You go, oh, that's interesting. And then, they're gone.
Yeah. And we all love to figure out what type we are. We all want to figure out what category we fit into. I'm no different. I just don't retain it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think having those categories is helpful in the moment because it helps us make sense of ourselves. It helps us kind of justify why we have our quirks and why we're frustrated with certain things. It's like, oh, so that's a thing. It's not just me being weird or difficult or something.
Right. I'm not weird. I think we all want to know that we're not weird.
Yes, I'm normal, just like everybody else in our own unique oddities. So then with that, tell us more about Harvard Business Publishing. What is the 30-second elevator pitch?
Sure. Harvard Business Publishing creates materials that help leaders be better at leading and helps people lead more satisfying careers.
So simple. And really, the range of articles, the range of research, the range of advice available through Harvard Business Publishing, anybody who has not taken a look at it out there, please go to the website and just check it out. The categories of information, you can distill it. It's such a trove of value that I can't speak highly of it enough. I've been a subscriber for years. Amazing, amazing stuff.
Thanks.
What's the most important leadership communication you had to learn, and how did you learn it?
Well, the most important leadership skill I had to learn had to do with giving up control. And my shorthand for it is learning to motivate rather than draw roadmaps for people.
Okay, tell me more about that.
So as you take on more and more responsibility in your career, you cannot get into the details on everything. For an editor, it means I cannot personally line edit every article. When I lead teams, I can't do every job. You know, that you've heard the expression, you know, you conduct the orchestra, you don't play every instrument in it.
Oh, I love that. Actually, I hadn't heard that before, but I love that metaphor.
Well, it's very useful to keep that in mind. It teaches you to delegate, and it also teaches you to trust. And I learned it when I realized, taking on more and more responsibility, that the way I had managed up until that point was unsustainable. I could not work 25 hours a day and 8 days a week.
Not the last time I checked. No, that equation doesn't work so well.
No, but the other thing that really became clear is that when you're in the weeds and you're micromanaging, you suck all the air out of the room. It's very demotivating for the people on your team. And you watch people kind of deflate. And you have to wonder why you, as a manager, aren't helping people feel great about what they do every day. And that was my lesson. I realized I was micromanaging.
I want to just repeat something I heard you say a minute ago, just in case it sort of skimmed by anybody. The question of, am I helping people feel great about what they do every day? That's a really powerful question to ask yourself. That's almost a coming to terms with your own reality, what impact you're having. I mean, think about the weight of that question. If you were to get up every day when you go to work and ask yourself, how am I going to make my people feel great about what they do every day? And then at the end of the day, when you're logging off, to reflect on that same question and say, did I do something to make sure that everybody on my team feels great about what they do every day? That's a powerful question of responsibility.
Yeah, it is. And it really comes home when you see someone rise above herself and shock herself by what she's accomplished. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. And you can do that as a manager by kind of clearing the way.
How have you done that? Can you give an example of how you've helped, what steps you've taken to ensure that people are feeling great about what they do every day?
It's often a process. It's helping people see how they put barriers in their own way and making sure people know that you're not going to second guess them. You know, I've coached, I've worked with people to become better at presenting or to lead more effectively, sort of by diagnosing what's going on, how they get in their own way, and then helping them get past it. I mean, you really have to take care of people. You can't embarrass people. You can't make them feel that they're failing. You have to do is make it clear that because you see their potential, you're investing in them.
Yes. I would imagine that there's a very fine line that we have to walk in helping others see where they're getting in their way. On the one hand, we have to be careful not to be hypocritical and saying, well, I've got all my own stuff, but I'm going to tell you what to do. So we have to be careful of our own where we're getting in our way so that our advice has more weight to it. But also in identifying an area in which somebody else may be, to use your words, getting in their own way, that in broaching the subject, it doesn't come across as criticism or judgment.
Yeah, exactly. And the way that kind of happens for me is that I recognize what's happening because I've done it.
Sure.
So often, for example, people have trouble presenting ideas to groups and doing it in a way that is persuasive. And often the reason for that is that they're afraid of what people think of them.
Yes.
And I've done this many times. I've said to people, everyone in that audience wants you to succeed.
Yes.
And everyone in that audience is standing up there with you. And they care about the quality of your thinking. They don't care if you use the wrong word or you forget where you were. Laugh at yourself and move on, because everyone in your audience has done the same thing.
Yes.
It's just reminding people that their expectations of themselves are usually a lot higher than others' expectations of them.
Yes. I think there's this, I've often said to clients that when we are speaking in front of whoever it is, there's this sudden fear that the audience has turned into a bunch of stereotypical cartoon high school teachers with a red pen just waiting to bleed all over their essays. And that's not how they are. There's nothing worse than watching someone speak and fall to pieces. The audience empathizes. You go, oh no, please, please, please. Like, you feel bad with them. It's uncomfortable for everybody. They want you to be successful. Also, because if you're successful, then they have the most value. They're completely self-interested as an audience member. They want to know what's in it for me. Am I going to get good use from my time listening to you? That's all they care about.
Right. Exactly. And also, people get a lot of joy out of seeing people soar.
Yes.
Most people are good people and they want others to succeed.
Yes.
You just have to have a lot of faith in your fellow man.
Which sometimes is a stretch. We'll give you that, depending on who the person is, but nevertheless.
Well, you can't do anything about the jerks, so you can't really let them rule your life.
Yes, agreed. So that's good stuff to keep in the back of our minds, too. Now, tell me about a time when you made the wrong call and had to fix it. Who did you approach first, and what did you say to them?
Great question. So when I first took the job, I have two roles here at Harvard Business Publishing. One of them is I lead the magazine, Harvard Business Review. And the other is I lead the editorial operation for all of our learning products. And I was new in the role. I had a lot to learn. I had a new team. We were trying to create something. We had a great idea. And we all sort of set about creating it. Well, I had never worked in an operation where the editorial product then had to be productized and brought to market. So I really know how to create content. The other two things, productization and go-to-market, were not areas of real strength for me. I just didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And so I set my team to work. We put a lot of time into creating this product, but just the editorial piece. We thought it was amazing. We thought we were awesome. Look at what we've come up with. And the business side were just, there was this weird sort of cocktail of surprised and angry and pissed and kind of baffled by what we had done. Mm. And I had to own it. I had to say to all of the stakeholders I hadn't even recognized in the first place, I screwed up. Mm. And I said, I screwed up. I didn't realize I had to, first of all, I had to have that little conversation with myself where I had to admit to myself that this was my fault, that I had wasted organizational resources, which is not a good thing to do.
Sure.
And then I had to go to the stakeholders and say, you know what? I am learning on the job. It's not an excuse, but forgive me. It is my fault.
Mm. How did they take it?
They were cool. You know, I owned it. What else were they going to do?
I presume that they were able to be cool with it because it was the first time that anything of that scale had occurred. They might be less forgiving if it were to repeat itself.
As they should be less forgiving.
Sure.
But, you know, the hardest part was telling the team and just saying, I'm pulling the plug on this and here's why. Because they had invested a lot of creativity and effort into it. And they took it fine.
Were they in the room when you brought it to the business side and got the feedback of heck no?
No.
So you had to report back to them.
You know, I think this was COVID. I think we were just at the beginning of the pandemic. And I think we were all sitting in our spare bedrooms or in our at our kitchen tables. And it was a team I didn't know that well. And I had to tell them in a team meeting. Mm. But no, I didn't have to get up in front of a cast of thousands and humiliate myself. It wasn't like that.
No, but nevertheless, even if you'd collectively created this product, this proposal, et cetera, and they had given it to you as their champion to take to the business side, expecting cheers to come back and approval ratings. And then instead it was, we're pulling the plug on this. I would imagine that would have been a hard message to deliver and to receive. How did you open the conversation? Because I think these hard conversations, yes, they're hard to have overall, but the hardest part is how to start. I think we avoid having difficult conversations when there's conflict, either potential or inherently likely, because we don't know how to begin. How did you begin that conversation?
I don't remember if I said it to the group or if I called individual members, Zoomed with individual members, but I said, I'm pulling the plug. Here's why. It's not about the quality of your work. You knocked it out of the park. I failed to socialize this idea and to win buy-in. And this is totally on me. It is not a reflection of your work. Mm.
And now that's interesting because I think a lot of people in leadership, ego would get in the way and they'd find some other excuse to not say it's on me for fear that everybody else would get mad at them or otherwise would look down on them or not trust them again in the future. How did you reconcile that?
You know, I guess I'm just at a point in my life where if people want to blame me, they can go ahead and blame me. I don't worry about being fired. Harvard Business Publishing has a very kind-hearted and generous soul. And the people I work for are truly good people. And there isn't a lot of finger pointing here. Mm. So I'm pretty lucky that way.
That's great, knowing that there's a little bit of that forgiveness.
Oh, there's a lot of grace here.
That's great. And tell me about an opportunity that you missed because you held back. Why'd you hold back?
I bet you a lot of your listeners will empathize with this. I got a call from a headhunter about a job I would have loved. Mm. This was years and years ago. And I held back. I actually said to her, why would that company want me in that job?
What was the job?
It was a leadership role. It was an editor-in-chief role and something I would have loved doing, but I didn't believe in myself. Mm. This was me getting in my own way. You know, I just didn't think I had the goods. I thought if I had taken it, I would have just humiliated myself from day one.
That's such a powerful question. And I'm sure we've asked ourselves that in everything. The notion of why would they want me?
Right.
That's such a powerful testament to sense of self-worth.
Yes.
And whether it's personal or professional or maybe a little bit of both, if you could go back now and have a conversation with your younger self of however long ago that was, how would you counsel her? Aside from just take the damn job.
I would tell her maybe she's not the best judge And I would say to her, these folks want you. They're asking for you. What's the worst that can happen? You don't get the job. Well, you're making sure you don't get the job by not even having an interview.
Yes. Now, Amy, tell me about a time when you decided to take a big risk. What was at stake and how did you communicate your decision to key stakeholders?
So it was kind of a personal risk. It was when I was offered the job as editor of Harvard Business Review.
Okay.
My spouse and I were living very happily in San Francisco. We had planned to spend the rest of our lives there. And this was a dream job for me. So I had to go to her and say, listen, this has come up. I'm not going without you. What do you think? And she wanted to do everything she could to support me, but we had to be honest with each other about what it meant to move from a place we loved to a place we didn't know.
Mm.
So the answer for her was yes, of course, but I need to work this through.
Obviously, she said yes in the end, because here you are. Sounds like it worked out. So that was a challenge for you and a challenge for her. So let's take this as a springboard opportunity to challenge the audience. It's time for our listener 24-hour influence challenge. So this is your opportunity, Amy, to challenge our listeners directly and give them a challenge to take one step that they can complete within 24 hours to have more influence.
I'll go back to the thing I had to learn as a leader.
Okay.
And I would like to challenge your audience to pull themselves out of the weeds, to figure out how to empower the people whom they oversee to do their work, and how they as leaders, how your listeners as leaders, can make sure that they're not micromanaging. Just take one step to stop doing that.
So for people who maybe are unaware if they're micromanaging or not, or what their definition of micromanaging is versus the people who they manage, what their definition of micromanaging is, what would be a first step to even find out? Do people feel like you're micromanaging?
Well, you can ask people on your team whom you trust. Do you think I give too much direction? Would it be better for you and your team if I sort of let you figure out how to get to the goal?
Okay.
You can also ask yourself. You have to be astringent with yourself. And you know, we've all been micromanaged. We know what it looks like and we know how bad it feels. Just think about an interaction you had with someone on your team recently where you may have been giving instructions, and ask if maybe you drew a roadmap when you could have just helped people see the goal and then unleash them to figure out a way to get there.
I would imagine that's difficult for some people where the ego finds it hard to use the word micromanaging, because I like the word justify ourselves. Just is a four-letter word in my space, because we'll use it to justify all sorts of not so good behaviors where people say, well, I'm not micromanaging. I just have very high standards. I just have really high standards. I'm a perfectionist and I just need to make sure everything's done because I have to turn it into my boss and I have to do this, and all these rationalizations for exceptionally high standards of quality. How would you help people to draw the line to distinguish what is truly only that versus where does it ooze into the micromanaging standpoint? How can you have one without the other?
Well, I start with just pointing out that there are many ways to get to the goal.
Mm.
There's not just one way. And your way is not necessarily the right way or the best way.
Or the only way.
Well, it's certainly not the only way. And so open your mind and get over yourself. The other thing I'd say is you should always assume good intent. And equally, you should assume other people have very high standards for themselves as well. Why would you be the only person with very high standards for herself?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
I just think you have to go in assuming the best, not the worst of people.
And that's sometimes just enough, right? The mindset shift, just right. Okay, give them the benefit of the doubt. Good intentions. Go from there. That can really unlock a lot in the mind and the heart alike. So, all right, everybody, check your inner micromanagement meter for a lot of alliteration. It was unintended, but watch that piece with your direct reports. Now, what's a communication skill that you weren't born with and had to learn? How'd you develop that skill?
Well, public speaking, certainly.
Mm.
Let me start with why I learned it. I realized I couldn't get where I wanted to go. I couldn't be who I wanted to be professionally unless I could get up in front of a group and lay out ideas in a way that was compelling and persuasive.
Mm.
So as I kind of climbed through the ranks, I got asked to give presentations or moderate panels or even give speeches. And the fear I felt was absolutely paralyzing.
Mm.
And again, I realized that was not sustainable. And I looked around and saw how other people just sort of marched right up to the microphone and started doing their thing. And so the only way I could figure out to do this was to say yes to everything. Just challenge myself. I said yes to every invitation to speak, every invitation to moderate a panel. And eventually, all that practice helped me get past the feeling that I was going to throw up on my own shoes. You know, it was bad, but everyone has that fear of public speaking, or most of us do. I'm kind of introverted. I'm happy sitting alone with a book. But I have to say that once I got past that blinding fear, I really started to enjoy it. I love the interaction with audiences. I love seeing people absorb an idea. I love hearing people laugh. I love taking questions. I kind of got to the part where it was fun.
I think people don't realize that it can be fun. And to look at the opportunity to have fun with it and have that be the driving force, the North Star, if you will, what they're aiming for, as opposed to only fixating on what I call the death spiral of what ifs. You know, what if I forget what I'm going to say? What if I don't give the right answer? What if they don't like what I say? What if the floor opens up and swallows me whole? You know, there's all the silliness that our brain goes into. Sometimes that's the wish, is that the floor would just open up and swallow you whole and then make it end. But to realize, no, it can be fun. That opportunity to provide value, that opportunity to play a little bit with the audience, that it's great.
Absolutely. I actually now really enjoy it and I look forward to it.
Yes. So see, everybody, you can do it. And for that matter, even I know a lot of extroverts who don't like public speaking. They are not synonymous.
No.
They may like speaking, but not necessarily in the traditional sense of with a microphone on a stage in front of an audience or something along those lines. So, you know, introversion, extroversion, that's not a get out of jail free card. We all got to be able to do it.
It's a little simplistic anyway.
I would agree.
Many of us are ambiverts. So,
yes. And it's really not a binary, it's a spectrum and contextual and all that kind of stuff. So, yes, let's take that category off the table as an excuse to just avoid the situation. Let's just work with it. And there's lots of ways around it. And it's fun. So everybody please.
And it's fun.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Amy, for validating that, because they don't believe me when I say it, because I'm more leaning towards the extrovert. And then I've been doing this for so long. It's second nature at this point. So like, yeah, Laura, you just. So thank you for being on the other side.
My pleasure. People should listen to you, Laura.
Ah, see, we just said that all the time. Don't we all have those moments where we think, if the world just listened to me, everything would be easier. And yet,
right.
And I would agree, we got to make sure everybody tunes into the Women at Work podcast as well. We need to listen to you a whole lot more often. Listen to these pearls of wisdom coming out right now. Love it. Now, was there ever a time that you went to bat for someone else? Who did you speak to on their behalf? Why and how?
This was many jobs ago. I witnessed a leader at the organization where I worked bullying someone who worked on my team, someone who answered to me. And I found it absolutely appalling. And I followed the bully into his office, shut the door, and said, if you ever do that again, I'm leaving.
Wow.
And then I called my partner and said, you know what? I might have just talked myself out of a job. So, you know, maybe we shouldn't go out to dinner tonight. Let's open a can of soup.
Yeah.
And I went home and didn't get much sleep. And came back the next morning, and as usual, I was in early, and he was in early, and I looked up from my desk around 8 in the morning to see him sort of leaning in the door frame, and I was ready for him to just fire me on the spot, and what I heard him say was, are we okay?
Interesting.
Yeah.
And what did you say?
I said, well, that depends. Are you ever going to do that again?
Wow.
And I'm not sure he ever answered me directly. I said, well, we're okay for now, but I meant what I said.
Wow. So now that obviously was a very different person from the person you had confronted the day before, at least as far as how he manifested in that moment. So when you did say it to him the first time and laid out that ultimatum, I assume he wasn't quite as calm in reception. How did he take it?
He was shocked. No one ever spoke back to him. I mean, that's the thing about bullies.
Yeah.
Is that they're pretty soft inside, generally. And I went in really angry as I've ever been.
Sure.
And said what I had to say. And he sat back when I said it, like he had been kicked a little bit. I don't think he ever expected that I would ever say something like that.
Yeah.
And then I walked out.
So he didn't give him a chance to answer.
No, I didn't. But I was so angry, I'm not sure I would have trusted myself in that moment.
Mm.
I rarely get enraged. I was enraged.
Good for you for taking that up and saying, you know what, I'm putting my own neck on the line if this is necessary, but enough is enough. And there are values and I'm not willing to break them. And silence on this front would be breaking my values.
Yeah. Also, I don't want to work for that person. I don't want to work at a company where that's okay. I don't want to work for that person. And, you know, we're all killing ourselves to do something really special.
Yeah.
And he was ruining it for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. That toxin just permeates everything. Did he ever do it again?
Not in front of me. And he actually proved to have a lot of integrity.
Hmm.
He's a good guy underneath that nasty hostility. He's a good guy. But, you know, that takes a lot of work to find that person.
I think we all have the potential to be good people underneath. Sometimes ego, fear, which is really the driving force of bullies anyway, is the fear of the uncertainty of, are you going to see the real me, that imposter syndrome and all those kinds of things is what creates that ugly armor on the outside.
I think that's right. And it goes back to the kind of job of a really good manager, which is to motivate and inspire. I was watching a documentary about the Patriots called The Dynasty.
Yeah.
Really, really good. And I heard an interview with one of the players on this. It really stuck with me where he said, we worked for Bill Belichick, but we played for Tom.
Interesting.
They played for Tom Brady.
Mm.
I get it. We worked for Bill, but we played for Tom.
Yeah.
Don't you want to be Tom?
Absolutely. So if you were to put in one sentence defining what the meaning is of that statement, what's the meaning of that statement?
We feared and respected Bill, but we loved and respected Tom.
It's very Machiavellian, isn't it?
It's very. I mean, I think that whole Machiavellian dichotomy is a little possibly simplistic as well. But yeah, it is Machiavellian.
And that's a perfect example of the two different poles of that continuum of sorts. So what a great example. Worked for Bill, but played for Tom. I'm making a note right now, and I think everybody else should too. Who are you going to be today?
And be Tom.
Yes, that was my next question. So everybody, are you going to be Tom or are you going to be Bill today when you get out on the gridiron?
Yeah, but note it took two of them to create the dynasty.
Yes, there's a little bit of Tom, a little bit of Bill can be necessary from time to time. Can't be all love.
Yeah, I haven't quite worked all of that out, but yeah.
What flavor of Bill versus what flavor of Tom, of course, is, you know, we don't want to be the nicey, nicey marshmallow. That's not what it means to be Tom, nor does it mean to be a dictator of sorts from the Bill. So the right balance, the right combination is always the challenge, but
right.
Great food for thought and great analogy. All right, lastly, Amy, tell me about a time when you had to laugh at yourself.
Oh my God, Laura, I laugh at myself all the time because, you know, every time I try to get super serious, I start laughing at myself. I laughed at myself this morning when I started to get very directive with my two dogs, for God's sakes. They're dogs. They have walnut-sized brains. I was running late. I had them at the end of the leash. I was saying, get in the car, get in the car, get in the damn car. And I realized, you know, they're dogs. They weigh 21 and 29 pounds. I'm just going to put them in the car. And then I thought, I'm the jerk here. And I just kind of had to laugh at myself. So yeah, taking yourself too seriously.
Isn't it funny how with pets, you know, we call them fur babies lovingly, but we do treat them like humans, like children, and we expect them to behave more rationally sometimes. And we have to get a little grip.
I actually heard myself say to the 21-pound, 15-month-old corgi, what part of get in the car don't you understand? And then I thought,
like,
well,
all of it.
Yeah, all of it. All of it.
Oh, that's great. All right, everybody. So ask yourself, where are you having moments where you're talking to your dog, metaphorically or literally, and asking them what part of your sentence didn't they understand? Because we all have those moments every day. So even when we're talking to our car keys, and we're talking to our cell phone, when we're talking to whatever it is that's not working right. What a great example. Thank you for sharing that. Amy, this has been a fabulous conversation. How can people learn more about you and Harvard Business Publishing and all the amazing resources that it offers?
Well, start with hbr.org. That's our hub. You'll find all of the great stuff we publish. You'll find our wonderful, wonderful roster of podcasts, our IdeaCast. We have another podcast coming up, new here for early career professionals. And then, of course, Women at Work.
Yes.
The podcast that you guessed it on. You know, keep your eye open. You can find us on newsstands. You can find the podcasts anywhere you download your podcasts or you stream them. I would say get to know us because we're not your father's HBR.
I love that. Yes, so many great examples. And you know what was fun for anybody who's like, oh, do I have time for another episode here and there? What was fun about being a guest on your podcast in particular on Women at Work was that it was a live coaching session in the moment.
Yeah.
It was a three-way conversation with an industry expert, and a young woman professional had called in and asked for guidance in developing her executive presence. And the other, you know, senior executive from the industry and I as the executive presence coach, the two of us kind of workshopped with her. And of course, with your guidance and direction, Amy, in the conversation. But it was so neat to have that opportunity to make a difference in real time in a half an hour, give or take.
Yeah, it was. And it was a really great conversation. And I always learn a lot in these conversations. So I hope our listeners do too.
It was nice to have that chance to have stuff, not just reporting, right, but to watch things happen in real time. So everybody, I highly recommend tuning in. So thank you again for joining us today, Amy. I've loved this conversation.
Same here. Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
And to everybody else, thank you as always for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice so we can help even more people to increase their confidence, presence, and influence. And finally, if you want to download my guide to equipment recommendations for virtual influence, including my picks for microphones, lights, and more, go to speakingtoinfluence.com. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, and you're listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite.
Thanks for listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite, the show for leaders who want to speak with impact. The hosts, producers, owners, and media distributors of the show make no guarantees that the strategies and information discussed will result in profit or other success and may result in losses. The opinions and statements of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the owners, staff, managers, broadcasters, or sponsors of the show. No medical or psychological therapy or personal or professional wellness or relationship advice is offered in the show. You are advised to seek counsel on matters related to your health, family, relationships, job, or other business and legal matters from licensed advisors in those areas prior to making any changes in business or lifestyle. No information provided may be suitable in your situation. As always, take responsibility for the decisions and actions you take, including the reactions they may make in your work, family, health, and life.